Case number 12-1243, American Road and Transportation Builders Association Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency and Gina McCarthy, Administrator, in her official capacity. Mr. Joseph for the petitioner, Ms. Mazniak for the respondents.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Larry Joseph for the American Road and Transportation Builders Association. There are three things I'd like to talk about, and one other thing that we may talk about. There's the history of the ARTBA cases and how they intersect with or diverge from the functional music line of cases, and that also involves ripeness. There is issue exhaustion, whether it applies to adversary, non-adverse proceedings, generally under the 2000 decision in Sims, or whether that requires a rethinking of that, of prior decisions that relied on sort of a mishmash of adverse and non-adverse precedent requiring issue exhaustion.
Yeah, we're not too good at rethinking our precedent. You need more people than three to do that here.
When the Supreme Court abrogates, undermines a decision, then I believe it's required. And so if we need to preserve that issue, okay, and the three of you aren't going to go there, then we can move on to futility. Because even if issue exhaustion is required, it's excused if there would be futility. So that's the second of the three issues that I'd like to discuss.
Is it futile because you've already been rejected two times before?
We petitioned twice for them to consider the rules. In 2001, they said that ARTBA's challenge to Texas state regulations in federal district court was an impermissible collateral attack in the Federal Register on an unrelated rule that we couldn't challenge because didn't have a horse in that race or a dog in that fight. And then in just recently here in 2013, they ignored our comments substantively because they say these waivers need to be judged by.
And in both of those instances, the opinion of our court said you're untimely.
Sure. That's the first issue, which I think is probably going to take the majority of our time. But as to the merits, being untimely is one thing, but on issue exhaustion, would our presenting the fullest
effect? In fact, isn't it correct that the brief you filed with us is word for word identical to the brief you filed in the last case?
In the merits section, yes. It's not word for word. There are changes that had to be made for the different contexts, but there certainly are on the merits sections, which have never been reached by this court because of the 307B jurisdictional issues. Yeah, we believe we can still carry forward the same merits arguments, which may get a hearing someday or they may not, but they were tailored.
Your bottom line is that the regulations are in violation of the statute, right?
Yeah, that I think we have the clear right to believe, and whether we get it heard or not is the question. So perhaps it's best to go over the series of cases, how they intersect with functional music, and when ripeness arises in each of them. ARTBA 1 is not important. That was an unreasonable delay case. It was mooted because EPA started a rulemaking that ultimately didn't reach these issues. ARTBA 2 was a straight petition denial. There was nothing else in that case but a petition denial. And there, the national mining case controlled, which is petition denials standing alone don't count. So ARTBA 2 is off the table, doesn't certainly prejudice from raising the same merits argument. ARTBA 3, we tried to twin a petition with a rulemaking applying that on the theory, under Auer versus Robbins, when you're raising a claim that a subsequent enactment or promulgation makes an earlier one arbitrary and capricious, that the disparate treatment between what used to be under the original rule and then the new rule, that creates a dissonance. It says that the only way to challenge that is by a 553E petition. So that's why we twinned a new petition in ARTBA 3 over the SIP rule, State Implementation Rule, out in California. I believe personally that ARTBA 3 breaks down into ARTBA 2 because this court said we lack the SIP approval is venue in the Ninth Circuit as a regionally applicable rule. And then, in a sense, we were left with ARTBA 2. We tried to twin ARTBA with a petition denial with an application, and we were unsuccessful, I believe, because of the venue provision in the Ninth Circuit. The second half of that decision goes on to say that the second half of functional music is basically the concept of renewed review, and there are two prongs to it. One is petition denial. That's the ARTBA 2 scenario. One is challenging a rule when it's applied. And the second half of the ARTBA 3 decision talked about that. And I believe that that is dicta because we'd already been reduced essentially in ARTBA 3 to the ARTBA 2 situation because venue is in the Ninth Circuit on the rule that we twinned it with. So once that venue, improper venue, was stripped out, we were left with just a petition denial. But on that issue, in the ARTBA 3 decision, the second half of that decision, there's a discussion about there is an exception, there's a constitutional due process concern about the challenging a rule in an enforcement context. And that, I think, has it exactly backwards, because there you have the second half of functional music is challenge a rule when it's applied, and application can be enforcement or it can be a non-enforcement kind of application, which is exactly what we have here. This is not an enforcement action, but it is an application of that rule. And under 307B2, there's the Congress has said, if you could have challenged something under B1 and you didn't, you cannot challenge it in an enforcement action. Well, that's surplus if the other half, the non-enforcement half of functional music's second prong, doesn't continue to apply, which is, of course, we can challenge an illegal rule when it's applied against us. In this instance, by the way, this rule did not become right until EPA granted the waiver, because Section 209E says that no state or subdivision shall adopt or enforce any rule relating to emissions. And so we couldn't have sued before EPA's waiver. In ARTBA 3, we were challenging a SIP rule, which is already extant as California law. We were injured by it. And so arguably that was ripe then, as the opinion said, before we filed within 60 days of EPA's action. Here, there was no ripeness until EPA acted. I hope, it seems like maybe the court is not interested in whether the proceeding was adversary or not, because it believes that doesn't matter.
I wouldn't say that. I'm very interested in that. Why is this so different from a rulemaking that
well, rulemaking is usually a non-adverse proceeding as well. What Sims said is that the case
But we require issue exhaustion there. Why shouldn't we require it here?
Well, I mean, other than the futility issue.
On futility, your consistency argument is a new argument. You haven't made that before.
I beg your pardon?
Your consistency argument is a new argument. You haven't made that before.
Which consistency argument is that? I'm sorry?
The 209 argument that you
made? Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well,
how does futility work there? You didn't.
Well, EPA basically says we're going to measure these against our regulation, not against the statute. And whether you defer to the regulation or not, or look at the statute as well, we think you need to look at whether the granting of the waiver is consistent. That's what the statute says, and it's not consistent. In fact, that's one point, again, that we couldn't have raised in 1994 that wasn't addressed by EMA versus EPA, the decision affirming those 94 rules.
Did I hear you correctly to say that until EPA granted the waiver to California, that your challenge to the rules was not right?
By rules, I'm talking about the California rules there. The California rules for which the waiver was granted.
But the rules that EPA promulgated, you're not saying, only became right for review when EPA acted on them and approved the California waiver?
Yeah. There's some language in the ARTBA 3 decision that I find confusing on that as well. And my understanding of case or controversy is a case becomes right, constitutionally right, because we have constitutional standing when we have not a dispute with how EPA has interpreted 209 in a paper they wrote or a regulation. We need a real-world context that creates the rightness. We've disputed, I suppose, the 209E rules, EPA's rules, since they were promulgated.
I guess, let me put it a different way. Are you now saying that your two previous challenges to the validity of the EPA rules were both unripe?
We're saying that each instance of ripening, I mean, that there were instances before where there was ripeness, but the ripeness arrives from the application of those rules to a context. The 209E rules don't regulate us. They don't really do it. They regulate states, I suppose, or EPA's personnel.
We review all the we constantly review regulations promulgated by agencies before they're applied. And there's a serious question about that, but it's not a question of ripeness. Sometimes it is, but most often it's not. So how do you distinguish? I take it you're making this argument because you're saying that this is that subsection B of 7607 doesn't, the 60-day period doesn't apply because we couldn't have challenged them before. We couldn't have challenged the rules before.
Right.
Yeah. Well, but we do that all the time in pre-enforcement review. So how do you distinguish?
This is a special type of rule. This is a rule, a META rule, M-E-T-A rule, that applies to future rulemakings. Most Clean Air Act rules, and the ones Congress was concerned about, as evidenced by 307B2, the prohibition against challenges in enforcement actions, they were concerned by new source performance standards, regulations that EPA promulgates that to apply to a polluter. As you have done lots of cases as well, in this other kind of rule I'm talking about, rules about rules. That is an example of a rule that can be applied and thus challenged under functional music's second prong without being applied in an enforcement action. And as far as the constitutional question that I believe you're asking, when EPA – so let me back up. There's a 2004 statute that we think reinforces our position. It's never been clear to me when we could have challenged that in any other case than the ones we've brought. But – and maybe this your decision will answer that. But when EPA comes, when Congress comes out with a statute that undermines EPA's META rules, it's not affecting us directly. We need a context. California's adopting a rule, and therefore we use that. So the ripening isn't the 2004 statute that we think reinforces our position. It's that California adopts a rule that then relies on the EPA rules, and EPA refuses to revisit their rules, notwithstanding the many things we've identified that have undermined them since 1994 or even 1996.
Okay, thank you very much. Your Honor, may it please the Court, my name is Kim Smasniak, and with me at counsel's table is Michael Horowitz from the Environmental Protection Agency. In this case, ARPA is straddling two conflicting positions. On the one hand, it has filed a suit challenging EPA's authorization of California's request to regulate a large spark ignition engine emissions under Section 209E of the Act, and it disclaims that it seeks to overturn EPA's longstanding Section 209E regulations. At the same time, the only claims that it raises in its merit arguments are the same ones that it first raised in 2002 in a petition to the Environmental Protection Agency, arguments that this Court has twice held are time-barred. ARPA also requests declaratory relief that would, in effect, require EPA to redraft those Section 209E regulations. Now, however ARPA's challenge is ultimately understood, there are clear grounds for this Court not to hear those challenges. First of all, assuming ARPA means what it says and it is only challenging EPA's grant of authorization to California, ARPA has waived those claims by failing to comment during the proceeding below. On the other hand, if ARPA seeks to challenge EPA's longstanding Section 209E regulations, that challenge comes decades too late for all the same sound reasons that this Court articulated in ARPA 2 and ARPA 3. To focus on the first framing of the case, which is...
We have jurisdiction over national rules, and the reason we have jurisdiction over this case is because...
There's been a long history in which this Court has had jurisdiction over these kind of waiver grants. In each one of the decisions, EPA, under its authority under the Clean Air Act, indicates that it views these as having national applicability.
Because any other state could adopt California's rules and get away with it.
That's correct, and that's the reasoning by which this is a national...
I'm curious, what if EPA denied California's waiver? Would we have jurisdiction over that?
If California denied it, I believe that...
No,
that,
EPA
or EPA denied California's
that
request...
That would have to go to the Ninth Circuit, wouldn't it?
I believe that this that has come before this case before, and there's been jurisdiction. I'm not familiar with that case, and I couldn't articulate the reasoning behind it. But I think that the impact of a denial would equally impact the states, other states' ability to adopt those regulations elsewhere. And perhaps that was the reasoning. But I have to be frank that I'm not familiar with that particular case law. So I want to turn to the first framing of the case, which is assuming that ARPA is really just challenging EPA's grant of authorization to California. Well, this court need not hear the merits because the administrative waiver doctrine plainly applies. And to give some context, in these, when California requests that EPA grant authorization to regulate non-road engine emissions under Section 209E of the Act, this court has held that EPA is sharply constrained in the scope of its inquiry. Firstly, the statute contains three particular factors that EPA is required and limited in its consideration. Further, this court has explained that EPA must presume those factors are met unless specific evidence is presented to support an opposite conclusion. And yet, ARPA here contends that its failure to comment, that its failure to offer any evidence or argument in that proceeding below as to why those factors are not met, should not excuse its ability to present those arguments here. While there are few cases that present as good a case for the exhaustion waiver to apply than this one. And ARPA instead relies on three different arguments, the first of which is Sims v. Apple. And it argues that the issue of exhaustion doctrine should not apply here because the administrative proceeding in which EPA considers comments on the requested authorization is not, strictly speaking, an adversarial one. ARPA's problem is that Sims has not undone the steady application of that doctrine in this court for rulemakings. In fact, the court squarely addressed this issue and rejected it in Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety versus Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. In that case, this court considered the exact kind of objection that ARPA raises here, examined its post-Sims case law, and concluded that the doctrine continues to apply. Moreover, the court identified sound reasons why the doctrine should continue to hold, notwithstanding the adversarial nature of those proceedings. But at any rate, even if the court were to consider Sims, ARPA is wrong to rely on it here. The reasoning underlying Sims is particularly forceful in this context as to why the doctrine should apply. Now, in that case, the Supreme Court considered that the nature of the adversarial or nature of the proceeding as an inquisitorial one was compelling. And that was because there the agency official was the one who was responsible for identifying and developing the issues that would be addressed during the proceeding. But in this case, in the authorization proceeding below, we have the opposite situation. There, EPA is constrained to presume that the factors are met, absent contrary evidence. And it is incumbent upon the opponents to a waiver to present their opposition. So even following the reasoning of Sims, we have a strong justification for the application of that doctrine.
Was this a rulemaking or an adjudication?
This is I think EPA considers this to be a rulemaking, but not one that falls within 307D. To turn to ARPA's second basis for the inapplicability of the administrative waiver doctrine, ARPA contends that it would be futile for it to have commented during the proceeding below. And here we see that the distinction that ARPA makes between its challenge to the authorization proceeding collapses with its real attempt to challenge EPA Section 209E regulations. Because in arguing that it would have been futile to comment during the proceeding, ARPA says that it would have been futile for ARPA to submit an additional petition for rulemaking. And it does not claim that it would have been futile for ARPA to present evidence relevant to one of the three factors that EPA has to consider during that proceeding. And that's a critical distinction. It's really irrelevant whether EPA would have granted or denied a third petition for rulemaking in this context. Instead, in order for the court to conclude that it would have been futile to comment, the court would have to conclude that it would have been futile for ARPA to have submitted some evidence or argument with respect to those three factors that EPA applies
in
that context.
Well, they say it's futile not because the and evidentiary considerations, but because they're the argument that they want to raise with respect to the validity of the EPA's regulations has been rejected in the past, so that's why it would be futile.
But in order to conclude that it would be futile, they would have to demonstrate and indicate, the court would have to assume that had they submitted some evidence or some argument that one of those factors was not met, that EPA would not even given it fair consideration. But EPA here specifically asked whether the three factors were met, solicited comment on that point, and processed the comments that it received. And we have to assume, as a court, that when EPA asked for that information, that it would have given it fair consideration. Whether or not EPA would ultimately agree with it is not the question. The question is whether EPA would have given it consideration in that context and weighed it as part of its overall proceedings. And here we have no evidence in the record to suggest that that's the case, nor does ARPA even focus its futility argument in that direction. To move to ARPA's third argument why the waiver doctrine should not apply here ARPA suggests an exception from whole new cloth, that the waiver doctrine should not apply here because EPA needs to update its legal thinking. This is a rather bizarre suggestion that I don't think comports with either the reasoning underlying the administrative waiver doctrine, nor does it fall into the reasoning for the narrow exceptions to that doctrine. And frankly, there's no sound reason why an agency's consistency in applying its regulations over a number of years would provide a basis for a person's party to fail to comment on a subsequent proceeding applying that. So I'm coming up limited on my time, but I want to highlight one additional final point for the court, and that is in Section 307B, Congress drafted strict filing deadlines, making it clear that of central importance in this regime is the finality of its Clean Air Act regulations. And it was clear that there was a legislative intent that they would funnel challenges to a regulation as it was promulgated. And this would give greater certainty to the regulated community once that regulation was upheld. It would also promote judicial efficiency, so that there would be no repeat challenges to the same regulation unless changed circumstances warranted. Consequently, it also reduces demands on the agency's time from repeat litigation. I would simply point out that ARPA's repeat efforts to litigate its challenges to EPA Section 209E regulations, despite this court's clear rulings rejecting those claims, it undermines those important goals of that statutory provision. And moreover, while ARPA claims that this litigation is its last of this kind in its reply brief, we have found that ARPA has yet again filed another petition for review, a case that would be ARPA 6 for this court. For these reasons, EPA respectfully requests that the court not only dismiss the petition, but also grant it its requested relief.
Thank you very much. Does Mr. Joseph have any time left? We'll give you 1 minute.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I just have one correction from my EPA counsel. With respect to this authorization, the EPA considers this not a rulemaking but an adjudication. That's a clarification. Thank you.
ARPA 6 was filed because we have a case pending in the Supreme Court and also this case. It's the case in the Supreme Court. If we succeed in getting petition denial review, we needed to file a petition. We've asked to have it stayed to wait for the Supreme Court. EPA has not opposed that stay. That was a necessary thing under the 307B rules on which EPA relies. ARPA has no real intent to litigate that if we don't get any relief from the rules because there would be no purpose to it. But we did have to file it. I haven't seen the advocate for highway safety case that my colleague referred to. If that indeed forecloses our Sims argument, then it does. That doesn't foreclose the futility argument. EPA has decided these issues. They have repeatedly not looked at the issues. We cited the 28J, their ORD, off-road diesel waiver, which is a parallel proceeding to this EPA-wise and then ultimately in a petition for review-wise. They just didn't look at it. They followed the original rules. If we can never get review for rules that are clearly outdated and unlawful, there has to be a time when we can do that.
The entirety of your argument with respect to EPA's grant of the waiver to California is raises just simply legal questions. Is that correct?
Yes.
No evidentiary material?
No. Just the only evidence would be the rule itself, and that's a legal fact.
Great. Thank you very much. Case is submitted.